From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, those open lines on this super moon weekend. Get ready for that. Here's what's happening. The United States and the United Nations have condemned the resumption of attacks between Gaza and Israel, urging both sides to cease hostilities. Israel's renewed strikes on Gaza on Hamas soon after the three-day truce expired was in response to rocket fire by Hamas, which controls Gaza. Hamas obviously is pushing away its concerns for its Palestinian people. More than 1,900 Palestinians, mostly civilians, have been killed in 4 weeks of violence in the Gaza Strip. U.S. fighter jets and drones repeatedly bombed extremists in northern Iraq on Friday, targeting what officials described as an ISIS artillery unit and convoys attacking the Kurdish regional capital of Erbil. The airstrikes ramped up America's involvement in Iraq, where ISIS, which calls itself the Islamic State, is seizing control of towns and key infrastructure, and in advance has forced hundreds of thousands of people to run for their lives, telling them to convert. And if they don't, they will be beheaded. Dr. John Curtis with us. John, this situation with us starting and resuming the airstrikes, how do you support that?
Yeah, I think that the justification for it, I think, was kind of a dicey one on Obama's part when he spoke last night. It was something to the effect that we're going to protect U.S. personnel in Erbil, which is the capital of Kurdistan. But the reality is there's 50,000 Yazidis that are holed up in a mountain near Sinjar. They're starving to death, and the Islamic State is going to massacre every 50,000 of them because they see them as devil worshipers. But, you know, the U.S. has gotten into this mess because I don't know if you've heard the reports that ISIS was fully armed with U.S. hardware, tanks, rocket launchers,
that's right,
surface-to-air missiles. And the story coming out of the White House right now is that somehow the Iraqi military fled and left all their weapons, and these were just seized by ISIS. This is completely false. What happened was McCain went over there in 2013, met with General Salim Idris, who was the head of the Free Syrian Army, and pushed the administration to basically supply arms to Idris, who in turn was working with his militia, which was ISIS in Syria.
Mm.
So ISIS became fully armed with U.S. War material, took over large swaths of Syria, and then moved back into Iraq when they realized that al-Maliki, his army was infiltrated and completely in chaos, incapable of defending, especially the northern territories. And the Kurds are our only real ally there. And for the last 6 weeks or so, ISIS has just been beating them down. You know, really, they're just taking a beat down over there because they've run out of munitions. The Peshmergas that are really a feared fighting force and have been fighting the Turks for years and the Iranians and trying to survive and create their own independent country have really been outgunned and run out of ammunition. So finally, Obama has decided to rearm the Kurds, you know, of course, against the wishes of the Turks and the Iranians, but trying to save these populations that are being massacred. I think when that church, that 4th-century Christian monastery, was besieged by these ISIS people, kicking out these monks and desecrating that 1,500-year-old artwork and artifacts out of that monastery. It's just a shocking realization that these people will stop at nothing. So I think it's the right move on his part, but it's not enough, and they're going to have to do much more in order to stop this group.
And I think they're baffled, John, too, that the Iraqi military just can't do it on its own.
Well, I think they're very concerned right now about Baghdad.
Oh, yeah. There's no question about it. And, you know, the president said last night, no U.S. troops there. But you know what? I'm not sure.
No, I don't think so. And I think there are U.S. advisors over there right now, and they're going to need a lot more our armaments in order to stop this group. Because, you know, what do we learn from September 11th, if anything, is that if you don't deal with this early on, and we know that the Clinton administration didn't deal with it very effectively, although there's reports that he says he could have gotten bin Laden and whatever. Well, that's really looking in the rearview mirror. Obama right now is going to have blood on his hands if that Kurdish population is massacred because these airstrikes don't work.
John, how would Vladimir Putin have handled this with Russia?
Putin would have moved in the Red Army, and he would have just wiped out this group, and they would have run for the hills.
Yes, and he would have annihilated them.
Annihilated them, absolutely. So, and unfortunately, what you've got with Obama is this president that believes that inaction, that his foreign policy has to be one of inaction and pacifism when he's letting things get out of hand in so many different areas of the world right now that, you know, that the inaction and the dithering and the sitting on the fence is really, making things worse.
Track John's work, onlinecolumnist.com. Thank you, John. The world truly in chaos. 40 years ago in Washington came the unprecedented resignation of a U.S. president. On August 8, 1974, after a summer of political paralysis and slowly released evidence of a brewing Watergate scandal, President Richard Nixon resigned as president as he was hounded by a potential impeachment process. He handed the reins of power to appointed vice president and unelected, by the way, Gerald Ford, and left for California.
America needs a full-time president and a full-time Congress, particularly at this time with problems we face at home and abroad, to continue to fight through the months ahead for my personal vindication would almost totally absorb the time and attention of both the president and the Congress in a period when our entire focus should be on the great issues of peace abroad and prosperity without inflation at home. Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
Next Tuesday on Coast to Coast, Nixon Secrets with author Roger Stone. Russia further tightened its control of the Internet, requiring people using public Wi-Fi hotspots to provide identification, a policy that prompted anger from bloggers and confusion among telecom operators on simply how it would work. The decree signed by the prime minister there, Dmitry Medvedev, also requires companies to declare who is using their web networks. The legislation caught many in the industry by surprise, and companies said it was not clear how it would be enforced. Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan, that's his name, has declared the outbreak of Ebola a national emergency and approved more than $11 million to help contain it. The move comes after the World Health Organization said the spread of the virus in West Africa was now an international health emergency. 961 people reportedly have died from Ebola in West Africa this year alone, two in Nigeria. And Dr. Kent Brantley, the American doctor infected with Ebola, released a statement Friday afternoon, his first since being brought back to the United States after he came down with Ebola. He said he feels stronger every day. Let's check in with the expert on infectious diseases, author of Pandemic, Gary Ridenour. Gary, this situation with Ebola, why is the WHO, WHO, saying that this is indeed a international problem now?
Well, it's one of the main reasons is that they're fearing that there is a high possibility of international spread. 1,779 sick, 961 dead, and they think that's only 20 to 50% of the cases being reported. Mm. It's called the African apocalypse. The world effort, it needs a world-coordinated effort, and it's not coming. Where is our African-American president? The African countries are very, very unhappy about our poor response. We sent 12 CDC sent 12 people to the region. 12 people couldn't stop the flu in a high school outbreak. It's ludicrous. And the It's a plane ride away right now. It's very easy for it to come, have a passenger on board in a transatlantic flight, suddenly gets up and they're going to throw up, and as they're running back to the bathroom, they start to throw up, they put their hand on their face and they spray about 15 people. Those people jump up and start flecking it off of themselves and contaminate another 15 or 20 people.
Unbelievable. And, you know, we've already got it in the United States with those two workers, volunteers, the doctor and the other person, the woman, who they're here. They're in the hospital trying to fight for their lives to see what, may happen on that at any day, Gary. That could be a big situation.
And the big question is that why do the Defense Threat Reduction Agency, whoever they are, spent $10 million in 3 years to develop that monoclonal antibody that a private company is claiming they developed? Why did they start 3 years ago working on this?
What did they know, huh?
I think they think somebody's going to use it for a biological weapon.
Good point, Doctor. Dr. Gary Ridenour. Here are some of the top three UFO cases, by the way, of all time. 1947, the Roswell crash. Number two, 1947, Kenneth Arnold's case. He's the person who coined the term flying saucer. 1952, the Washington, D.C. UFO flap, where they were flying all over the place. I'd also put Rendlesham in that list as well. Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. And Peter, what do you find in the skies these days?
Well, those were certainly good cases that you mentioned, George, but in my opinion, there have been some equally dramatic ones that have taken place in the subsequent 65 years or so. But the volume of incoming reports seems to have relented a bit from what I saw in July, for which I'm infinitely grateful. I was working...
I'll let you get caught up.
Very hard. Yeah, we posted 1,185 cases in the month of July. And it's one of the great mysteries of ufology, why some nights... or some days, rather, I should say, I get anywhere from 40 to 50 solid reports, whereas other days it drops off to 4 or 5, and it strongly suggests to me that it's not just what the volume of reports isn't determined by something that takes place on this planet, but rather by visitors who come here and in waves and cause these reports. But just this morning, very interesting case, the 8th of August at 45 minutes past midnight on East Coast time, the Eastern time zone, Safety Harbor, Florida, which is located just west of Tampa, I believe, and east of Clearwater on the west coast of Florida. Two men were sitting on the edge of a public swimming pool, and one of them, who'd never seen a UFO before, looked over the shoulder of his friend, saw a brightly illuminated disc. He estimated it was about half the diameter of a full moon, go streaking across the sky, covered his effective entire sky in about 5 seconds. That very interesting report is now posted to our website, ufocenter.com. Two nights ago, Jamaica, the nation of Jamaica. A lot of people may think that these clusters of red lights that I've been babbling about for almost 2 years on coast to coast are limited to the United States. Not the case. On Wednesday night, the 6th of August, a family that lives in Paymel, I think is the name of the city in south central Jamaica, saw a distinctly red light coming towards their house. It scared them. One of the daughters had gone out to feed the dogs, and she saw this thing coming at her, and she forgot the dogs and headed straight back to the house, went right over their house, scared the whole family, scared the daylights out of them. And I've had 3, maybe 4 similar reports already tonight from Kaukauna, Wisconsin, from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Scranton, Pennsylvania, and Gardner, Pennsylvania. We'll have those reports posted very soon.
Super. Track Peter, UFOCenter.com. Great cases. Every day, people acquire ordinary personal and household items that secretly come with spirit attachments, demonic forces, curses. They are shocked when the haunted objects create a paranormal nightmare. In a moment, John Zaffis, star of The Haunted Collector on Sci-Fi, and Rosemary Ellen Guiley with their latest work, Haunted by the Things You Love, next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. What a great night we have for you tonight. Rosemary Ellen Guiley is one of the leading researchers, authors in the paranormal and metaphysical fields. Her multifaceted work includes all kinds of entity contact experiences, interdimensional portals, ghosts, dreams, hauntings. She's a co-author with me in Talking to the Dead. And she, of course, has written this new book with John Zaffis, Haunted by the Things You Love. Rosemary, welcome back to Coast to Coast.
Hi there, George.
Looking forward to this. And, of course, John Zaffis, more than 30 years of experience studying and investigating the paranormal. He has had the opportunity to work for and with his aunt and uncle, the late Ed and Lorraine Warren. John has assisted and worked with well-known exorcists, including Bishop Robert McKenna, the late Father Malachi Martin, Reverend Jun, and through hands-on work and other investigators and clergy, he has obtained an incredible deal of knowledge and understanding of the supernatural. Here's John Zaffis back on Coast to Coast. Hey, John, how are you?
I'm doing good, George. How are you?
Good, good. And I take it that your work on Haunted Collector on Sci-Fi with Rosemary is probably the focus point for Haunted by the Things You Love.
It's pretty close.
I love it. Well, we're going to talk with both of you about these various dolls and objects. But, John, I want you to start by telling us, what do we mean by spirit attachments?
When we deal with these items, a lot of times what we're referring to is it could be residual energy that's attached to it. It could be several sources of energy that could actually be summoned and attached to an item. Or we could be dealing with religious objects, occult objects. In all of these different types of things, George, we have to look at differently because we have to realize with certain items that energy is deliberately attached to them. And that could be a little bit more difficult to deal with than just dealing with, like, a haunted dresser, a clock, or a piece of jewelry. So it really is an intense type of situation when you start researching into these items and realizing that you could be dealing with something that has a deliberate intent purpose that the item is given to somebody to really wreak havoc within the paranormal realm against an individual.
And this item, did it have to be owned by a human at the time who was pretty bad?
No, it could be something so innocent, George, but here again, when we deal with these items, a lot of people, you know, especially years ago, George, you know, people didn't have a lot, and certain objects always meant a lot to people. You know, a piece of jewelry or, you know, a family Bible, you know, certain things, a favorite chair. And a lot of times their energy can remain with these items. We call this, you know, human spirit energy, and it's not really anything negative. But a lot of times when things aren't followed through, you know, when, let's say, grandma passed away and she wanted this brooch to go to one granddaughter and the chair to go to somebody else, and a lot of times when family members don't follow through with grandma's last request, grandma could really wreak havoc.
Oh, no doubt. And Rosemary, it's as if we have just another thing to worry about. Now personal and household items could be haunted.
Even new objects can be haunted. Usually, however, they are secondhand. They've been passed on down through a family or picked up at an estate sale, a yard sale, a flea market. As John was saying, intense emotions can create thought form energy that becomes imbued into an object. People may have spirit attachments that they aren't aware of, and their emotional attachment to objects, the spirit will transfer itself to the object when the object leaves the ownership of that person. Then we've got the most insidious kind of object of all, which is one that's been deliberately cursed. And we feature a number of stories in the book where jilted and scorned lovers in particular wanted to get back, at a man or a woman, and they deliberately cursed an object and sent it into the house like a Trojan horse to just wreak havoc.
Nice people. Well, we're going to go through some of these objects and have both of you explain where they came from, what happened, and then what is going on. I'm George Norrie. We shall be back in a moment as we're talking about Haunted by the Things You Love right here on Coast to Coast AM. We are back with Rosemary Ellen Guiley and John Zaffis talking about the work Haunted by the Things You Love. And what we're going to do is talk about some of the objects here with stories behind it and what has happened. And in these cases, John Zaffis, how do the objects get possessed with these spirit attachments? What is the common denominator that makes it happen?
The majority of the time, when we deal with situations where items did not go where they belong, or they come in contact with people, I found where there's been items, you know, antiques, where they've been around for hundreds of years, no one's ever had any issues with them, but they can come in contact with certain types of people. And I believe very strongly that once the energy of an individual could intermingle with that item, and, you know, we have this force that takes place, it could trigger something. More so with sensitive people that pick up items, antiques, or, you know, different things from estate sales, I think they need to be a little bit more careful and guarded, because I do feel that, again, when people don't follow through with certain requests and certain things that they'd like to see happen with their possessions, it can trigger a haunting once it ends up with somebody else.
Sure can. And Rosemary, with the many cases we're going to go over here today, all of them seem to be darn right scary.
They certainly can be, John, and or George, and John's on the other line. they certainly can be. And we picked out some of the creepiest and best cases from the hundreds of objects that John has in his museum. When we get the calls, people are usually terrified. They have phenomena going on in their house. They've got nightmares, black shadows. Creepy things are happening. Everything goes out of control, and they don't know what to do. Sometimes they don't even associate it right away with the object. We have to narrow things down by a process of elimination to find out what's going on.
Okay, let's go through these. Tell us about the object and what it, who had it, and then what happened. Let's start with creepy clown dolls. Tell us about this. Who wants to start, you, John, or Rosemary?
Oh, I'll take this one, Rosemary. When people collect these collectibles and they purchase them, they pick them up, this story just turned into something, George, that just totally blew my mind. A woman went to a thrift shop. She picked up two of them, and she was adding them to her collection. And she started having activity. They were moving around. All kinds of things were happening. Well, she was totally petrified of them, and she just wanted them removed from the house. So we went in, we removed them, and I put them in the museum. Well, about a week later, I get a telephone call from another woman explaining to me that she picked up a collector series doll, brought it home, added it to her collection. Then I find out that both of these women had purchased these clowns from this consignment shop. So naturally, being an investigator, I go in and I'm talking to the woman. We're going back and forth, and the woman just looks at me. She goes, "Why are you questioning me about these clowns?" And I said, "Well, you know, two customers were having paranormal issues with them." And she goes, "I knew all those clowns had something with them." And I went, "All those clowns?" She goes, "Yeah, John, there was a total of five of them."
Oh, jeez.
Well, now three of them were with me, and there were still two out there. Well, one day I'm coming home, and on my front porch, you never know what you're going to find from the mailman. So a box arrived, and there was clown number four that a woman had purchased. And then several months after that, my wife and I were coming back home, and my wife says, "Uh-oh, there's something on the front porch, probably for you." There was clown number five.
So,
all separate women, not knowing each other, purchased these clowns from the consignment shop, and all of them had problems. Well, needless to say, I called up the woman that owned the consignment shop, and told her, I said, the fifth clown had arrived. And she said, well, good for you, John. You keep them all over there at your paranormal museum.
She didn't want anything to do with them, did she?
She would not even allow them in the store anymore. She told me she would no longer take clowns on consignment.
I don't even like, John, real-life clowns, let alone little clown dolls.
Well, they definitely are interesting, and, you know, it's kind of crazy. The original intent, you know, was to make people laugh and, you know, have a good time. And just over the course of time, they really developed that creepy feeling, and people really get terrified of them.
What's the one about a teenage boy who buys an ugly idol head doll or something? What is that?
Go ahead, Ro.
This was a ritual object that a teenage boy found in a yard sale. He was attracted to it because it was so ugly. You know how teenagers are.
Yeah.
And he brought it into his house and got the idea that it was like thoughts sort of implanted in his head that he should start doing some magical rituals with it. And he got books on magic. He was under a spirit influence, and he didn't really realize it because this object had been used in dark ritual magic. And like a lot of teenagers, he shut himself off in his room, you know, private territory, parents do not enter. His parents were very liberal and allowed him to have his space. And over the course of time, this kid deteriorated from a clean-cut kid who was holding down a part-time job, getting good grades in school. He started not sleeping well. His grades were slipping. He was just really coming apart. And finally, this entity that was attached to the idol was able to gain a hold on him. And he was in a state of a type of possession when he finally confessed to his parents that he thought something very dark and evil was trying to kill him, and it was inside this ugly head, which looked so horrible, you would wonder why anyone would want to buy it. And it took quite a bit of effort to get him free of this terrible source. And, you know, he's had to be on guard for years afterwards to not be taken over again. Oftentimes when people have severe afflictions like this, they have a vulnerability that lasts for a very long time.
Has anybody died by being next to any of these objects? And, you know, when you go in to investigate, you know, they see this dead person and there's the object, like, next to him?
I haven't had any situations of that, but there are several stories out there in regards to items. I mean, there's a very famous chair over in Scotland that's up on a wall in one of the pubs, and it was alleged that anyone that sat in that chair, George, would end up dying. So many, many years ago, they just picked the chair up and they put it high up on the wall and nailed it up there. And to this day, it is rumored that anybody that touches the chair or has anything to do with it will end up dying.
Jeez. John, tell us about the museum. How many objects there?
Oh, George, I don't even know anymore. There's just so many different items. I would venture probably to say at least a good 2,000 items these days, you know,
wow,
at this point. Dolls, pieces of furniture, clothing, things that you would least expect. And then on the flip side of it, a lot of occult items that have been removed, things that were used in rituals, religious items. Again, people use these in a negative perspective. They bring them into their homes, you know, not thinking anything of it, and they could start to wreak havoc. I recently had removed a statue that was donated to a church, and it was wreaking havoc. All kinds of crazy things were going on. The minister was flipping out, everybody. So I removed it, brought it home, did everything I needed to do, and I put it in the museum, George, and I started to get puddles of water appearing in front of it.
Puddles of water.
Puddles of water. And, you know, again, when these types of things occur and happen, that definitely tells you that these things were used in some type of serious ritual.
Sure.
So then I got involved with talking to the family that, you know, the statue came from. We had found out The woman was a deep, dark practitioner into all kinds of things. And here they innocently donated her statues to this church, and it started to wreak havoc.
John, you would think that with a museum of 2,000 haunted objects, that it would be a hotbed of all kinds of paranormal activities. So first question here is, I mean, are things happening at the museum?
Yes. George, I don't pay attention to much after 40 years, to be honest with you. It takes a lot. I want to see somebody flip. I want to see a house rise before I pay attention to it. But I work with a lot of universities and colleges within my area, and they have paranormal groups, and a lot of them, you know, they'll come in to do investigations. And, George, some of the activity they have just is totally mind-blowing that they come back with. My paranormal group and several other people have investigated in there, and they come out with some really phenomenal EVPs and, you know, psychic photography. But with me, George, I don't pay attention to too much of it. I'm just so used to the barn, you know, different things occurring and happening out there. But it's always good to see people validating the objects. They walk through and, you know, they'll say, you know, this is creepy, or this is something weird over here, and they'll basically validate not knowing the story and telling me some of the information about it.
Can you detach a spirit from an object?
I do believe it does occur. See, the biggest problem, George, is we can't get the info from them, but a lot of times there are certain rituals I use to be able to clear an item, but the majority of the time with it is I will bind the energy to it. I work with a lot of spiritual people, and I have them do the same thing. So therefore, I'm hoping by binding that energy to the item and sealing it and breaking the connection, you know, especially within residential homes and there's children and everything involved, I definitely tell people, please do not keep haunted items in your home. And, you know, it can just wreak havoc because it's become very fashionable. People collect them today in their homes.
Well, how do they know the object is haunted in the first place? I mean, let's say I had some haunted keys.
Mm-hmm.
How would I know that they were haunted?
You really don't until, you know, you purchase them, you bring them in your home, and people start to have activity. Or they start experimenting with it, doing EVP sessions or doing different things to see if they can get any type of proof that the item is legitimately haunted.
Rosemary, tell us a little bit about what is called the deathbed.
Well, this is a great example of an object where people know that it's haunted and they want it because they think that's really a terrific thing. It's a conversation piece. This was an item that was brought over from Africa by a couple of wealthy collectors in a company, and they liked the offbeat. It was a big slab of wood. It is a big slab of wood with kind of a saddle headrest on one side. It's probably a viewing bed where a corpse would be laid out prior to a funeral. And so a husband and wife brought it home, and things started to happen in the home. Poltergeist phenomena, dark shadows. The wife especially was affected, started feeling ill a lot, got to have a lot of chronic health issues going on, and she felt that it had to do with this bed. It just had a bad feeling around it. So she finally convinced her husband to get rid of it, and somebody else in the company wanted it. They thought it was neat, a haunted bed. Nothing was going to happen to them. They could bring it into their house, so they get it. The same stuff starts happening. Illness, foreboding, a bad atmosphere. And they were going, the second recipients then were going to get rid of it. Another employee in the same company heard about it and wanted it. Cool, a haunted deathbed. So this guy gets it and brings it into his home, where he's living with his girlfriend, and they start using it as a coffee table. And this black shadow starts showing up in the house. Once again, the whole scenario starts again. Now, usually in a household, even though multiple people might experience things, there's usually one person who gets the brunt of it, the person who seems to be the most sensitive to the energy, like John was saying. And this happened to be the girlfriend. And finally, she freaks out and says, I'm leaving. It's me or that coffee table. And the boyfriend thinks she's kind of nuts, but
yeah.
takes off. So that's when he finally called John, and John took it out. After he got it, we did a lot of research to try and find out exactly what this bed was. We were told different things, that it had been used prior to cremation services, that it was something that should have been thrown into the fire, too. I had a source in Africa who was knowledgeable about burial customs. He opined that it was probably imported to the company, maybe by somebody of Hindu faith, for corpse viewing, maybe prior to cremation. A big, heavy piece of a wood that probably wouldn't have just been used for one purpose. And he said probably there's at least one angry spirit attached to this bed. Didn't want to be taken out of the country, didn't like that, and was perhaps even earthbound, kind of lingering around this bed, and getting into the right environment then started acting out in a very nasty way. Everybody who comes into that museum, myself included, has a bad feeling about that deathbed.
That's scary. I mean, of all of them we've talked about so far, outside of the clowns, that's scary. Because to me, it just feels as if there's death surrounding it, Rosemary.
Yes, absolutely. Unhappiness, misery, pain, sorrow. It could have accumulated all kinds of residual energy from mourners as well as from people who had passed over. We have no way of tracking down how people died who may have been laid on out on that bed, how many people might have occupied it. So it came with a very tangled up, energetic history. And here were people who knowingly wanted to acquire this item because they thought it was so cool. It was a conversation piece. And this is the kind of thing that, you know, John was talking about earlier, object misuse. This was something that had a very sacred purpose originally and was completely misused by turning it into a tourist attraction and then into an ordinary household item.
I had heard, Rosemary and John, that some of the furniture that was in the room where the exorcism of that little boy, where the movie was made about him, it ended up, you know, being about the girl, but it was really a little boy, as you both know, that the furniture that was sold at auction to people, that they were haunted by these things.
One of the things I have also heard, George, yes, I've heard the same thing. I had heard that the furniture from where he was in the hospital is literally, at this point in time, it was purchased by somebody, and it is in storage. The complete room where one of the exorcisms Whoa. Evidently took place, and this person has all of it.
You know what? He may be a collector, but he should get rid of it. Then how do you get rid of it? Can you burn it? What happens, John?
One of the key things is, if at all possible, to get it into a location where it's not going to cause any more issues, for one thing. That's probably why the gentleman has it in storage. But burning an item or breaking an item, you must be extremely careful. Now, the average person, if they start doing these things, and there is energy attached towards, you know, with the item, and they destroy it, that energy is going to gravitate right towards them. So there are set procedures for certain people that would know of the proper way to, you know, burn an item or break an item. And I always recommend to them, please just get it removed.
We're going to come back with Rosemary Ellen Guiley and John Zaffis. Their work, Haunted by the Things You Love. More of these stories when we come right back.